Parkland courses on the PGA Tour and are faced with the same kind of target golf week in and week out that turns most tournaments into putting contests. Both types of courses might place the same demands on your ball striking, but require different shots. For example, you can get away with the occasional errant tee shot on a Parkland course, where long ball hitters with high trajectories thrive. Hit that same drive on a true links course, and you might wind up waist deep in love grass, or even worse, a gorse thicket. You can also hit a wider variety of shots on links courses, including knockdowns, bump and runs, and high, soft shots. Factor in the wind, where 1 minute you're hitting a 9-iron 180 yards, and the next a 3-iron 150. And you can appreciate the need for knowing how to play different kinds of shots, plus having the nerve to play them when the situation dictates. I'm not a happy camper when a course is deliberately set up to take the driver out of the hands of long hitters like myself. I don't mind 6-inch rough, as long as it's not brought into play by altering the course. I've had to adapt to shrinking landing areas, sometimes as little as 30 yards wide. Adaptability is another part of course management. Sometimes you just have to take what the game and or course superintendent gives you. Here are some do's and don'ts of course management. Do: establish a game plan before the round, not during. Don't chuck it at the first sign of trouble. Stick with it. Do get the correct yardage to both the front of the green and to the flagstick. Don't get fooled by sucker pins. Play to the fat of the green when necessary. Do know when to go for it and when to play safe. Don't let an inflated ego do the same thing to your score. Avoid the big number. Do accept that there is such a thing as a good bogey. Don't attempt a specialty shot in competition that you haven't practiced. Do shape your shot off the tee to take one side of the fairway out of play. Don't ever aim your shot so that if it goes straight, it will wind up in trouble. Do play your own game. Let your opponent play his. Don't forget that it's just a game. Have fun. I always try to be prepared for the unexpected. Like those times when I have to rely on my creativity and imagination to pull me out of a tight spot. That's one of the reasons I love links golf so much. You get to use every ounce of your creativity, sometimes on the same hole. For example, 200-yard 9-irons and 100-foot putts are not uncommon. Being able to control distance and trajectory is critical at any venue, especially those. Know when to hold 'em and know when to fold 'em. The most common mistake amateurs make is grabbing the driver on a hole that is designed to be played as a layup. Sometimes conditions, for example, if the hole is playing downwind, and circumstances require that you pull out the driver and go for it. Make sure the reward is worth the risk. Most often, though, it's best to play the percentages. Use a long iron or a utility wood and play to a certain yardage. By that I mean, if you know the water hazard is 225 yards from the tee, use the club that, when struck solidly, will hit the ball short of the hazard. Also, if you have a pet distance for your approach, say 110 yards, hit the club that will leave you that yardage into the green. Manage the course. Don't let it manage you. I have been known to buck the odds, usually when I felt I had nothing to lose and everything to gain. I fought my way back into contention in the final round of the 1997 AT&T Pebble Beach National Pro-Am and was just a couple of shots back of my friend Mark O'Meara when I got to 18. Even though I killed my drive, I still had more than 270 yards to the green, and the wind was not that favorable. I really never thought of laying up. I felt I needed to eagle the hole to force a possible playoff, so I had to go for it. Fortunately, my driver off the deck found the green. Although I missed the putt and finished a shot behind Marco, I felt good that I didn't back off a green light opportunity. Had it been another situation, say if I was tied for the lead or up by one, I would not have risked hitting my second shot into the ocean. Find your natural rhythm. When I'm really on, course management becomes almost second nature. It seems that I know instinctively what shot to play. If most of the trouble is behind the greens, then you can believe my misses aren't going to be long. If there is trouble to the left, I make sure my shot is shaped to avoid that trouble. And I don't really have to think about it. I call it finding your natural rhythm. Every golfer has one, and it starts during your pre-round warm-up. I also adopted my pre-round practice routine from Jack Nicklaus. I always use the same 6 clubs, working my way up from the sandwich to the driver. The last club I hit is the one I intend to use on my first shot of the day. My purpose is not to work on my swing. If I don't have it when I arrive at the course, I'm not going to find it in a 30-minute warm-up. My purpose is to establish my rhythm. I want to make sure I go out there with the right rhythm. That's when I'm on. When I'm out of rhythm, I can't find the on switch and every swing becomes problematic. How I manage my game that particular day can mean the difference between hanging in there or shooting myself out of it. Fortunately, I've been able to hang in more times than not, and so can you. Keys to control. While the game itself at times appears to move in slow motion, some things occur in a millisecond that can have a dramatic effect on the execution of a shot or outcome of a tournament. Knowing how and when to jack yourself up and calm yourself down are two of those things. For example, if I need to hit a big drive and I've been a little lethargic, I can get the adrenaline going immediately. On the other hand, I can throttle back on a shot simply by composing myself and inducing calm. No one can do it for you. You have to do it yourself. It's a matter of being in touch with yourself mentally, physically, and emotionally. At times, I've had to fight off negative energy as well as a loose golf swing. So next, I'll talk about how to master the mind. Winning psychology. The true essence of golf is capitalizing on opportunities and minimizing mistakes. It is a thinking man's or woman's game to a great degree. I believe that my creative mind is my greatest weapon. The best way to describe it is a kind of inner vision that enables me to see things others might not, like a certain way to play a shot or a slight opening in a thicket. And I've been blessed with the physical ability to execute whatever shot my mind dictates. Your creative mind should be your greatest weapon too. While managing your game, you should be constantly assessing situations, factoring in variables like changing course conditions, and deciding on whether or not to play the percentages. The psychology of golf goes a step further than course management. It entails mental toughness, self-confidence, intimidation, gamesmanship, conquering inner demons, instant recall of past successes, and being able to quickly purge failures. It is the game within the game. Mental toughness was the second gift to my game from my dad. He wanted to make sure that my powers of concentration could withstand any and all distractions. Golf is not a game for fragile psyches, so he worked to strengthen mine. He established 2 rules from the outset. First, he forbade me to talk during a round, in which he pulled every dirty trick in the book, from dropping a set of clubs in the middle of my backswing to walking directly in my line of sight as I stroked a putt. The second rule was that there are no more rules. Anything goes, and it did. He had no idea whether I could hold up under such difficult circumstances, so he provided me with an out, a secret code word that only the two of us knew. Don't ask me how or why. Perhaps it was pure stubbornness, but I never used it. The toughest part was not talking. Although if looks could kill, my pop would not have made it through my formative years. Pop delivered on his promise. Some distractions are easier to block out than others. For example, I've learned to deal with camera shutters going off in the middle of my swing. I still get upset when it happens, but my reaction is directed at the offender more than the offense. I realize that fame comes with a price. I don't know how I can stop in the middle of my downswing. I just know when it's necessary. In retrospect, I guess that's what Pop was preparing me for. Other distractions, however, can knock the wind out of you like a blow to the solar plexus. The key is not letting them affect your performance. That's what happened to me during the final round of the 1999 PGA Championship at Mindanao. I had survived some loose swings and managed to go up by 5 shots with 8 holes to play. 2 holes later, I'm standing on the tee box of the par 3 13th when Sergio Garcia holds a birdie putt to cut my lead to 3. I'm sure he felt the game was on, but I was concentrating on what I had to do, realizing that was the only thing I could control. I made an unlucky double bogey on 13 when my tee shot wound up in deep rough, just off the green about 20 feet from the hole. As I walked to the 14th tee, I felt something I never had in competition. All of a sudden, the crowd, which had been so gracious and supportive all week, seemed to switch its allegiance to Sergio. Perhaps they were naturally rooting for the underdog or wanted a close finish. I don't know, but I could feel the negative energy directed toward me. When I hold the little 18-incher for a one-shot win, I let out a huge sigh of relief. I not only withstood the challenge of a gritty young challenger and a truly tough stretch of finishing holes in a major championship, I did it against some difficult psychological warfare. I was mentally and emotionally drained. Confidence is easier to define than it is to measure. It is an assuredness in one's ability to accomplish a task even under the most stressful circumstances. Success breeds confidence. It's similar to when you're on a roll with the putter. Seems like the hole is as big as a basketball hoop. You can't miss, nor can you wait to get to the next green. Your confidence builds with each putt you hole. Pretty soon, you're on autopilot, playing by instinct and feel. That's as close to finding your own game as you can get. Sometimes we think too much instead of trusting that inner voice that says you can do it. We think ourselves right into a bad swing or a costly mistake, and our confidence suffers as a result. I know, it's happened to me, although I must say I was younger. Self-confidence was never an issue. Take my nature as an aggressive putter, for example. When I was a kid, I would knock a putt 5 feet past the hole and drain it coming back without even giving it a second thought. Only when I started thinking about the consequences of a miss did the hole begin to move on me. And too often, I've developed a case of leprosy. Intimidation is also difficult to put a finger on. How do you intimidate someone in a game where there's no physical contact? In football, if you have some guy 6'5", 250, bearing down on you, and you're 180 pounds soaking wet, that can be intimidating. But in golf, intimidation is purely a state of mind rather than a fear of bodily harm. If you buy into the fact that you control your destiny, you'll never let another player impose his will on you or intimidate you. I also learned that very early in my career. I was an 11-year-old hotshot playing in the junior world at Torrey Pines in San Diego. I had plenty of experience competing against guys much older, and I didn't scare easily. My first round opponent, however, was huge, about 6 feet, 180. Although he was only a year older, he could have been a defensive lineman on the varsity football team. To make matters worse, he was strong as a bull. His first drive took off like a rocket, eventually landing in the middle of the green of the par 4. I nearly freaked out. In fact, I was so intimidated, I could barely breathe. I was not the same the rest of the week, barely speaking to my dad. On the way home, Pop asked me why I'd been so quiet, and I confessed being afraid. "Afraid of whom?" he asked. "The big kid," I said through a hard swallow. "Look, son," Pop said, "golf is played not by size, but by skill, intelligence, and guts." That's all he said, leaving me to chew on the words for a while. Great players like Gary Player and Teddy Rhodes surely learned that lesson too. I didn't know if I would ever grow big and strong, but I did know one thing. I'd never be intimidated by anyone or anything again. Gamesmanship in golf is a lot more subtle than in other sports. Baseball great Babe Ruth would point to an area of the outfield where he intended the ball to exit the ballpark. Hall of Fame running back Jim Brown would drag himself up after a hard run as if he were taking his last breath, unintentionally stepping on a tackler in the process, then plow through the line with even more force on the next run. No one talked more trash than Michael Jordan and Larry Bird, both superstars in a sport where cockiness and the ability to back it up on the court are accepted behavior. If you can get into your opponent's head and throw him off his game, that might be the edge you need in a close game or match. I've had players pull a variety of things on me, from giving me a hard, cold stare after making a putt, to hitting a certain club on a par 3 and suggesting to their caddy that they had hit another. I love the mind games. They're part of the fun of golf. I have mine too. Here are my top 5. Feel free to try any or all of them. Really lean on a drive, then react as if you mishit it. On your way to a drive that you've nutted, take a quick look at your opponent's ball as you walk by. Hesitate for a moment as if you think it's yours, then proceed to your drive. Concede two or three short putts, then make your opponent putt a kick-in. Make your opponent putt several give-me's, then concede a questionable two-footer. After you've outdriven an opponent on a day marred by swirling winds, take a club you have no intention of hitting on your approach shot and make a few practice swings. If he's stealing your club selection, you might get him to guess wrong. Guys like Freddie Couples and Ernie Els are so easygoing, you'd never know from their demeanor what they're thinking. Others, like me, are more emotional and demonstrative. What we have in common is a competitive spirit that drives us to perform to the best of our abilities, and an understanding that sometimes our best isn't good enough. Truth is, we fail more often than we succeed. You can't let those failures get to you, because they will erode your confidence and chip away at your psyche. Pretty soon, those inner demons will have you second-guessing everything from your swing to your putting stroke to the color of socks you're wearing. I personally have never experienced them, but I know some players who have not been as fortunate. The reason I've avoided those little devils is twofold. First, I refuse to give in to fear, real or imagined. I'm not talking about nervousness. I'm as nervous as the next guy every time I tee it up. Every competitor has a certain degree of anxiety. It goes with the territory. No, I'm referring to being afraid, either consciously or subconsciously, of anything or anyone. I've heard of players being afraid to win. Imagine that. When I turned pro, I took a lot of flack because I said my only purpose for playing was winning. I was only being honest. Second place still has no appeal for me. I would argue that most champions have that mindset. In order to be truly successful in any endeavor, you have to adopt a no-fear attitude. Don't be afraid to go for it. Second, I refuse to yield to pressure. Some players wilt like lettuce when the heat is on. True competitors love the battle. Sure, it gets intense and your nervous system is tested, but that's the most fun part of being a competitor. Ever wonder why Michael Jordan and Jack Nicklaus were so good in the clutch? Simple. They loved the spotlight and were inspired to reach another level of greatness by the need to accomplish. Give Michael the ball with the game on the line, or Jack a must-make putt, and watch them produce. That's because both of them had a winner's attitude to handling pressure, staying in their natural rhythm and routine, and focusing solely on what they needed to accomplish. Michael would bounce the ball a certain number of times at the foul line, spin the ball between his hands, and fire away. Or he would beat a player off the dribble and never take his eyes off the basket until the ball had left his hands. And no one has ever concentrated on the task at hand better than Jack Nicklaus. If you aspire to greatness, or if you're just seeking to get the most out of your ability, then you must be devoid of fear and oblivious to pressure. Building blocks to mental toughness. A player can become mentally tougher by learning from his experiences. The mind is like a computer with thousands of megabytes of memory. Store your experiences for when you will need them again, because the game is a constant learning process. You should learn from your failures as well as successes. Ask yourself what you did or did not do right in a situation. A lot of times, you'll find it's the same thing over and over again. First, learn from your experiences, both positive and negative. Rallying to win three consecutive U.S. juniors and as many U.S. amateurs taught me the value of a never-give-up attitude. Having lost a few leads, too, reinforced that attitude. Second, take ownership of your mistakes. Every shot is your responsibility. When I drive it into the junk like I did on the last hole at Dubai in 2001, I can't blame anyone but myself. I hit the shot, and I had to accept the consequences. It's not always easy, but it's fair. Third, never make the same mistake twice. It took two visits to the tributary at Augusta National's 12th hole in the 1999 and 2000 Masters to convince me never to be short of that green again. Both times the wind got me, but that's no excuse. The wind is always a factor there. Fourth, don't be afraid to turn a negative into a positive. Someone once accused me of hitting into trouble so I could make a heroic recovery. They thought I got a rush out of it. They were only partly right. I would never intentionally hit into trouble, but I must admit to seeing opportunity where others might not. It's fun being able to hit a flop shot off of a downhill lie within birdie range like I did at the 8th hole in the final round of the 2001 Masters. Again, I had hit it there, and it was up to me to make the most of a dicey situation. Finally, never beat yourself up, because there are plenty of people who will do that for you. I am my own worst critic, but I will never do anything to undermine my confidence, nor will I be influenced by anyone's criticism or scrutiny of me. I was supposedly mired in a slump because I had gone 6 straight tournaments without a win at the start of the 2001 season. Well, we all know how that turned out. You have to be tough enough mentally to handle all potential distractions. Lay back in match play. Golf is also a game of action and reaction. Knowing when and how to do either is a matter of experience. A lot of the strategy I employ when a medal play tournament turns into match play is the result of past success and failure. I've learned when to be proactive. For example, sometimes I'll hit less club off the tee, so I can hit first into the green and apply pressure on my opponent. The first time I used that strategy in a pro event was in a playoff against Davis Love III at the 1996 Las Vegas Invitational. Davis bombed a driver in perfect position on the first playoff hole. I followed with a 3-wood because I knew I could keep it in play with that club and hit short of his ball. Even though my approach was 20 feet right of the pin, he felt some pressure to get it inside me. He pulled his shot into the left bunker and made bogey. I 2-putted for par and my first win as a pro. Recognizing when to be proactive and when to be reactive comes with experience and a feel for the situation. A quick recovery. I've hit a variety of snipes, quacks, and shrimps in my lifetime, and if I continue to play, I'll hit plenty more. I realize that a poor shot is just a swing away. I also realize that once I've hit a poor shot, my only recourse is to hit a better shot on the next swing. In other words, I've learned how to hit it and forget it. There's no sense dwelling on a mistake. You can't hit the shot again, so forget about it. The same thing applies to my occasional emotional outbursts. They're no more than a release, and once I get it out, I'm fine. I realize that some of my comments, albeit self-directed, are X-rated, and I apologize if they offend anyone. I wish I could vent without looking like a jerk. Unfortunately, I'm still working on it. With that said, there's no better feeling than when a shot comes off exactly as you planned it. In order for that to happen consistently, though, you must commit totally to the shot you're trying to hit and trust your swing to deliver it. One without the other is a recipe for disaster. Power of positive thinking. My mom is one of those people who can find a silver lining in the darkest cloud. I guess I got my positive outlook from her, just as I got my relentless, never-ever-give-up attitude from my dad. Both require total belief in yourself and the ability to live with the outcome, whether good or bad. The road to failure is paved with negativity. If you think you can't do something, chances are you won't be able to. Conversely, the power of positive thinking can turn an adverse situation into a prime opportunity for heroism. The final round of the 2001 Bay Hill Invitational is a perfect example. I took a 1-shot lead into Sunday, but my swing abandoned me, and with 3 holes to play, I trailed Phil Mickelson by a shot. I managed to birdie the par 5 16th despite another errant tee shot, and my birdie putt at the par 3 17th singed the cup before sliding by. On the tough par 4 18th, I hit another snipe off the tee that hit a spectator. Fortunately, there was no injury. Even better, the deflection kept the ball from going out of bounds. Still, I faced a shot of 192 yards into the green, the last few yards over water to a pin tucked back right. I was confident that if I trusted my swing, even though it had been shaky all day, I could pull off the shot. I hit a little cutter that settled about 15 feet from the hole. The sweeping putt was center cut too, and I won by 1. Never did I let a negative thought enter my head. Never did I give up. Sometimes you look to be a hero, sometimes it finds you. Because I believe in myself, it has found me several times. Creating the will to win. I'm asked all the time about my ability to focus and stay in the moment when the pressure is on. It's simple. I realize that the only thing I can control is my game. That is my only security blanket in a game where you could easily feel naked to the world. I can't count on controlling what the other player is going to do because most top-level players are concentrating on their own games. Sometimes you win tournaments, other times they're given to you. The key is to consistently put yourself in a position to win. That's the only way to get used to the pressure. So when you're faced with a must-make putt, you know the feelings that go along with it. More important, you know how to deal with them. Control yourself, and you control your destiny. When I apply pressure on opponents, it is a matter of controlling my game better than they do, a shot at a time, moment by moment. There is no sweeter feeling than knowing what I have to do to win, than calling on all my emotional control to pull it off. Further thoughts. Playing great golf is much more than developing solid fundamentals and sound technique. It's about keeping everything in perspective. So with that in mind, let me talk about how to get strong. When I turned pro during the summer of 1996, I weighed 150 pounds in full golf gear. That's pretty light for 6'2". I knew I had to get stronger and build up my entire body to endure the rigors of professional golf. I also wanted to add some shots to my arsenal that required strength. In addition, I knew that my body had not fully developed and that my swing would suffer as a result. It was particularly evident in my short irons. 1 minute I would hit a 9-iron 150 yards and the next 170. I needed to develop my muscles for consistency. The first couple of times I played in the Masters, I had trouble hitting the green with a sand wedge in my hands. I would either blow it well over or suck the ball off those sloping surfaces. I remember being particularly frustrated by the ninth hole there during my debut in 1995. I hit what I thought was a perfect drive on number 9 each round, well past the crosswalk, and twice my approach shot came rolling back down the hill to my feet because I hit it into the slope with too much juice. I would really go after a sand wedge in those days when I should have been hitting a little wedge and controlling the spin. Those little arm shots weren't available to me then because I wasn't strong enough to hit them. So one of the things I did as a pro was alter my diet and increase my weight while limiting my body fat. I developed a physical fitness routine that would allow me to work every part of my body. I wanted to have effortless power and the ability to hit little finesse scoring shots. And when I really had to lean on one, I wanted to be able to do so without losing my balance. In order to accomplish my goals, I had to get stronger. I've always been into physical fitness, so it was just a matter of refining my workout to include stretching, aerobics, and weight training. My intention was to work every muscle, so I would not only increase my strength, but my endurance too. I don't know how much stretching Sam Snead does, but I'm told he is one of the most flexible athletes ever. He could kick the top of an 8-foot ceiling when he was 75 years old. Sam could also touch his left thumb against his left forearm without help from his other hand. Even more amazing was the sight of Sam bending over and picking his ball out of the cup without bending his knees. Talk about flexible. The man was like a rubber band. I'm sure that's a big reason for his longevity in a sport where the longer you play, the shorter your backswing gets. That's because the muscles in the upper body lose their elasticity through the aging process and restrict the shoulder turn. Sam is living proof that you can minimize the effects of time by remaining flexible. How I keep my muscles limber. Here are several stretching exercises to help keep your golf muscles supple. Do them gently at first, and if you feel pain, scale back. You should check with your doctor before beginning any exercise or fitness routine. Lower back. From a standing position, bend from the waist and try to touch your toes. Hold for 20 seconds. Repeat as many times as you wish. From a sitting position, bend from the waist and try to touch the floor between your feet. Hold for 10 seconds. Repeat as many times as you wish. Often during my warm-up, I will take a club and hold it across my upper back and shoulders parallel to the ground. From that position, I'll slowly make shoulder turns back and forth to stretch out the back muscles and loosen up. Hips. Lie on your back with your legs extended. Lock your hands under your knee and pull your leg toward your chest while keeping your other leg extended. Hold for 20 seconds. Repeat with your other leg. Chest. From a standing position, lock your hands behind your back and raise them while fully expanding your chest. Hold for 20 seconds. Repeat as many times as you wish. Shoulders. From a standing position, extend your left arm over your shoulder behind your back and try to grab your right hand, which you have reached under your shoulder and behind your back. Hold for 20 seconds, reverse arms, and repeat. At first, you might not be able to touch your fingers, but as the muscles stretch, you should be able to give yourself a low five behind your back. Hamstrings, hammies. From a sitting position, spread your legs as far apart as possible. Try to grab your left foot with both hands while keeping your legs extended. Hold for 20 seconds. Repeat with your right foot. Hands and fingers. A lot of players don't realize the importance of flexibility in your hands. Shake your hands for a few minutes like a swimmer does before competition. It will help you develop soft hands for those touch shots around the greens. I learned the value of staying in shape as a youth running cross country. I also learned that the harder you run, the quicker it's over. That's why I run as fast as I can for 3 to 5 miles whenever the weather and my schedule allow it. When they don't, the stationary bicycle is a nice option. When I first started on the bike, I had to set it at almost a beginner's level. Even then, my legs felt like they were gonna fall off only after a few minutes. My stamina increased gradually. Now I can ride that baby at nearly the maximum level of difficulty until I'm ready to quit. That's how you should approach each part of your workout, with caution. Build your routine slowly to avoid injury and maximize the benefits. At the conclusion of your run, take 10 or 15 minutes to cool off before beginning the rest of your workout. During this time, completely clear your mind of all thoughts. Train yourself to think of nothing at all. You'll be surprised how refreshed you'll feel afterward. It's also effective when you run into a traffic jam on the golf course. Clearing your mind for even a few minutes will sharpen your focus when you really need it. Here are 12 keys to healthy running that have worked for me. First, I dress appropriately for the weather. Light clothing in warm weather, layered in cold weather. Second, I find a comfortable pair of running shoes, and I change them before they wear out. Third, I wear a wool cap in cold weather. Fourth, I always stretch before I run. Fifth, I avoid running during the heat of the day. Sixth, I never run on a full stomach. Seventh, I drink plenty of water before I run. Eighth, I maintain a steady pace. Ninth, I include hilly terrain in my course. Tenth, I cool off for 10 to 15 minutes before resuming my workout. 11th, I drink plenty of water afterward. And 12th, I always stretch after I run. I believe great physical conditioning gives me an advantage when I have to play 36 holes in a match play event like the U.S. Amateur or the Ryder Cup, or when the weather has forced a postponement. It gives me an extra gear when I need it. I needed it during the final round of the 2000 NEC Invitational in Akron, Ohio, a real marathon because of a weather delay. We finished that tournament in near darkness, and I felt just as fresh in the end as during my warm-up that morning. Fatigue can affect your focus and cause you to make a bad decision. I never want to lose a tournament because of a bad decision precipitated by being out of shape. In Akron, being at my physical best helped me stay mentally sharp and allowed me to claim another trophy. As an international player, I have traveled through half a dozen time zones in 24 hours. And I believe being aerobically fit helps my body recover quickly so that I'm able to compete at the highest level. My road trips take me to Bangkok one day and St. Andrews the next, but being physically ready to play should still be a priority. Remember your cardiovascular system, and it will pay off in the long run. Weight training is exactly that, training your muscles through the use of free weights or an exercise machine. I believe it is necessary for a player to maximize his power and control. That's why I train every muscle, among them tris, tricep, biceps, bicep, quads, quadriceps, pecs, pectorals, and abs, abdominals. I do curls for girls and also to build some powerful biceps. Here are some of the best strength exercises for golf. The upper body is your swing's engine. You have to keep it fine-tuned to maximize performance. I want mine operating on all cylinders in the heat of competition. Here are some recommended exercises to strengthen your upper back, shoulders, chest, arms, and abs. Lat, latissimus dorsi, pull downs for the upper back. seated rows, a rowing motion from a seated position for rotator cuffs, overhead press for shoulders, horizontal bench press, incline bench press, and some type of fly for the chest. The last is a favorite of bodybuilders and one that you should work your way up to. The exercise requires you to lie flat on a bench with dumbbells in each hand. Hold the dumbbells palms down, parallel to the bench. Extend them away from your body and in an arcing motion, bring them up until your hands touch above your chest. You must keep your elbows slightly bent. Don't lock them. Pushdowns, dips, or overhead tricep extensions, any combination for the triceps. Horizontal and vertical wrist curls for the forearms. Standard stomach crunch. You can do them anywhere. And knee lifts up to your chest for the abs. Just as form is an important element of the golf swing, it is also an important factor in weight training. Always maintain good form to get the desired results. Remember to start out moderately and exercise caution. Don't take on more than you can handle. Building up your muscle strength while you're young will help you maintain it as you get older. A healthy body and a more powerful swing that lasts a lifetime will be your ultimate reward. How I use a weighted club. Increasing and maintaining flexibility in my muscles has had a positive impact on my overall performance and has helped me avoid injury. It is a major part of my physical fitness program, which consists of a total body workout of about 1 to 2 hours, 3 to 5 times a week, depending upon my schedule. I also recommend the use of a weighted golf club without a ball to assist in the warming up before a practice session. It is great for stretching out those upper body muscles, but you must swing it slowly. If swung properly, a weighted club can also increase your swing speed. I loosen up first. I warm up my muscles. I start each swing from the address position. Easy does it. I swing the club slowly and deliberately to avoid pulling a muscle. I swing the club. I don't let the club swing me because its momentum can pull me all over the place if I'm not careful. I maintain my body positions, especially my spine angle. Remember, any workout routine must be regimented and consistent. You can't lift weights this week and not the next. It requires a real commitment to building a powerful body, toning it, or whatever your overall goal might be. I lift 3 to 5 times a week. My pre-round routine is dictated by my tee time. For example, I might eliminate weightlifting and concentrate more on the rest of my workout for an early tee time. The key is to be loose, fluid, and in my natural rhythm prior to and during a round. I use different amounts of weight for different parts of my body, and I vary my reps. Of course, the heaviest weight is reserved for my legs, which are the strongest part of my body. I like to work with free weights because I can set my body in different angles and positions to work on different moves, plus they provide more range of movement. I can also work on my stabilization muscles in particular areas better, but occasionally I'll use a machine when free weights aren't available. To avoid pulling a muscle or straining myself, I always stretch before lifting, and I never do heavy lifting without a spotter. Most physical fitness experts recommend working different body parts on different days. For example, you might concentrate on your upper body today, legs, and lower body tomorrow, then upper body again the next day, or you might lift every other day. Variety can keep your routine from becoming monotonous and make it more fun than work. You might also consider mixing a light cardio day with a heavy lifting one. You must customize your routine according to what works best for you. Again, I would caution you to get a complete physical examination before undertaking any strenuous exercise regimen. Make no mistake, weight training not only works the muscles, but the heart too. Since legs provide the foundation for a golf swing, I would recommend the following exercises to help you build a solid base. Extensions, curls, presses, plus regular squats and hack squats. The last are probably the single most important exercise for building strong legs. They really work the quads, hamstrings, buttocks, lower back, and gluteus maximus. It's also a terrific exercise for developing overall stamina and strength. You have to be very careful with squats, though. It's easy to pull a muscle, so try not to overdo it. For the average person seeking to build and maintain muscle strength, I recommend 2 sets for each exercise. The first set of 10 to 12 reps at a weight that doesn't exhaust you. For the second set, I increase the weight by 15 to 20%, which should increase the difficulty about the same amount. For example, you might only be able to complete 7 or 8 reps of the second set. That burning sensation in your muscles is a sign that you're getting the best results from your workout. Changing my eating habits was the hard part. It meant cutting back on my two favorite food groups, fast foods, cheeseburger fries and strawberry milkshakes, and faster foods, pizza, hot wings, and tacos. When I became of age, I also liked to share a beer or two with friends. I quickly learned that in order to increase my strength through muscle, I had to avoid grease and cut out all empty calories, non-nutritional foods, anything cooked in oil or fat. I'm about 180, 180 pounds, and my percentage of body fat is a bogey on a par 4. So while there is still room for improvement, I've done a decent job of putting on the right kind of weight. But more importantly, my energy level and stamina are the highest since I was a kid. I attribute it to watching what and when I eat. I can't plan your diet for you because everyone is different. What works for me might not work for you. There are, however, some foods that are not conducive to good health. I recommend that you minimize your amount of dairy fat, like cheese, cream, and whole milk products, and pick leaner cuts of meat. You don't have to become a vegetarian. I'm not. In fact, I still have a cheeseburger every once in a while, but I never pig out on them. I pick my spots. The key is moderation. Find out what works best for you and stick with it. Your physical fitness routine will be more effective if you follow a balanced diet. Here are some of my dietary do's and don'ts. I avoid teeing off on a full stomach. I also eat at least 2 hours before my tea time to give my food time to digest. I drink plenty of water before and during the round. I keep a good supply of nutrition bars in my bag for instant energy. Sport drinks can help me avoid dehydration. Fruits are a good source of energy, namely apples and bananas. I avoid sugar highs from chocolate during a round. I also avoid heavy food, hamburgers, hot dogs, etc. at the halfway house. They can make me lethargic. Additionally, I avoid late meals. I give my food time to digest before I lie down. Most desserts are deadly. I substitute fruits and frozen yogurt. I've tried to limit my salt and sugar intake, but I'm still a sucker for Mom's sticky rice and mangoes. Good thing she doesn't make it too often. You need a little bit of fat to maintain your weight. Just don't get carried away. Here are 10 foods to help you win. Foods that are high in nutrition but low in fat. These include any vegetable or fruit that is orange in color, cantaloupe, sweet potato, squash and carrots, most green vegetables and fruits, turkey, whole grains, baked broiled fish, baked grilled chicken, skim milk, egg whites, rice, and fruit juices. And here are 10 foods to lose. Food loaded with empty calories, including pizza, ice cream, cheesecake, roast beef, prime rib, fried chicken, fried fish, gravy, potato chips, ham, and soft drinks. I've already admitted being a fast food junkie when I was younger. I remember Pop's lecture about the evils of fast food. "Son," he said, "enjoy your youth, but you know those foods are not healthy for you. Someday you'll decide on your own to eat healthier." He said it was my responsibility and that he didn't want to deny me the kind of pleasure a kid derives from a Big Mac, fries, and a shake. Boy, was I glad to hear that. "But with age comes responsibility," Pop said. "I know you'll take responsibility for your own health when that day comes." That's all he said. Pop was right. That day came sooner than I thought, and I'm much the better for it. You will be too. How to play enjoying the journey. I don't know the exact percentage, but a great number of novice golfers find the game too difficult, get frustrated, quit, and never touch another club. I also know of some very good players who experienced success in the game, but somewhere along the journey lost their zeal for it and walked away. I believe they lost sight of the reason they fell in love with the game in the first place. Golf hooked them not because they were good at it, but because they derived great pleasure from it. I played several sports as a youth. I also ran cross country and really enjoyed it, but golf was the most fun. It still is. I mentioned earlier that golf was like a childhood friend. While other kids were stuck inside on bad weather days, in a state of boredom, I was being entertained by golf. I turned our living room into a chipping area. I would hit flop shots off the carpet over the coffee table and land the ball short of the fireplace. I never broke anything, although I came close a few times. People are always asking me about the pressure of tournament golf. I'll let you in on a little secret. I had to hit those floppers so they made little or no noise, because if Mom had heard me hitting balls in her living room, she would have blistered my behind. The pressure of tournament golf pales in comparison. During the summer, Pop would drop me off at Hartwell Golf Course on his way to work, and I would spend all day on my playground. I would arrive at 9 a.m. and go straight to the practice range. I'd play 9 holes, take a lunch break, then play 9 more. Then I would work on my short game until Pop picked me up. Every once in a while, Stuart Reed, a member of the European PGA Tour who lived in Long Beach, would come to Hartwell for a practice session. Stuart and I became fast friends. We would have so much fun practicing, trying to outdo each other. I was only 5 or 6, and no way could I match his long game, but I gave him a run for his money on short shots. We would create situations like trying to putt the ball directly behind a light pole or lobbing it into a trash can. The fun part was creating shots to escape obstacles. Sometimes Stuart would show me how, other times I'd discover it myself. Golf has always been a game to me. The most fun I ever had, though, was playing with my dad. The competition got pretty fierce at times, though. He established par for me based on how many strokes it would take me to reach a green under normal conditions, plus 2 putts. For example, on a natural par 4 that took me 4 shots to get to the green, because I couldn't hit it that far as a kid, my par would be 6. We also played all kinds of shot-maker games. For example, Pop would pick out a target, and we would see who could hit it closer to that target. The trick was, you couldn't hit it straight at the target. You had to either cut the ball or hook it and vary the trajectory, and you had to call it in advance. Some of the shots you see me hit in competition today were dug out of the dirt of a practice range in shot maker games with Pop. We would always laugh, share a big hug and a soft drink afterward. Well, I would have a cherry Coke. Pop's choice was a little stronger. The game should never be boring, especially when you're working to improve. I have just as much fun on the practice range and green as on the golf course. I love working on shots, carving them this way and that, and proving to myself that I can hit a certain shot on command. You can build a lot of confidence in your game and have fun doing it by trying these games during practice. Different club, same distance. With the exception of the first few wedges that I hit to warm up, I always hit to a target. So, use the 150-yard marker as your target. Start with your 150-yard club. For me, it's a hard 9-iron. And work up to your 2-iron, hitting balls to the target. This is a great drill for controlling distance by controlling arm speed. 9-ball. Pick a spot about 5 yards off the chipping green. Use 9 balls, 3 each for 3 different clubs. The lob wedge, pitching wedge, and 8-iron. I'll sometimes substitute my 3-wedge. Hit to the hole farthest from the spot. See how many shots you can get up and down with each club. Keep score. You'll be surprised how quickly your feel around the green will improve. I play a similar putting game using driver, sand wedge, and 2-iron. It's great for helping ingrain the feeling of releasing the putter head. Putt and pull back. You'll need a partner for this game. The two of you must putt from the same distance. Whoever is farthest from the hole afterward must increase that distance by a putter length. The objective is to hole out in the least number of strokes. The winner selects the starting point for the next hole. There is not a better drill for lag putting, especially if you have lunch riding on the outcome. Flop it. I wouldn't suggest hitting flop shots in your living room like I did, but you can get similar results by using your shag bag. Place it, or a bucket, or a towel about 15 yards away and see how many balls you can flop into it with your lob wedge. H-O-R-S-E. It's played just like the basketball game. Toss a coin or a tee to see who goes first. That player selects a spot from which to putt and keeps honors as long as that player makes the putt. The second player must answer. That player gets a letter for every missed putt. Whoever spells horse first loses. My friends and I always have some kind of competition going during practice, unless we're preparing for a major championship. Then we concentrate on the task at hand. We always find a way to make the game fair and fun. One of my favorites is played like strip poker in reverse. It's a team match. The team that wins the hole loses a club of the other team's choice from the winning team's bag. It's the only game I've played where the winner actually loses. Here are some other games sure to keep things interesting. Wolf Pig. Ideally, this game is played by a foursome. By coin toss or tee toss, a player is selected wolf on the first tee. That designation changes on successive holes so that each player has been the wolf four times through the 16th hole. The wolf has the option of choosing a partner after the tee shots or playing the other three on his own. The selected player can deny the partnership, taking on the other three himself, thus becoming a pig. Points are accrued on each hole. The player with the least amount of points loses to everyone. Umbrella. This is a six-point game played among partners. Single points are awarded on each hole for low ball, closest to the pin, and birdie. If a team has the high score on a hole, it must surrender a point to the other team. 2 points are awarded on each hole for low total. If a team gets all 6 points on a hole, that total is doubled and the umbrella goes up. It's like the white towel being waved by the losers. Vegas. You need an accurate scorekeeper for this one, because every player's score is used on each hole. The low score between partners is put first. For example, if I make a 4 and my partner makes a 6, our score is 46. If our opponents score 45, they get 1 point on the hole. If a team makes birdie, the other team has to reverse its score. For example, if the other team scores 47, it will be 74 as a result of my team's birdie. If both teams birdie, then both scores are reversed and the difference awarded the team with the lowest score. You might find this hard to believe, but even when I'm grinding on the final 9 of a tournament, I'm having a blast. Admittedly, some players are more demonstrative with their enthusiasm. Lee Trevino interacts with playing partners and the gallery. Chichi Rodriguez entertains. Arnold Palmer says more with a smile than with 1,000 words. I believe even the most stoic player is having the time of his life when the game is on. If he isn't, he shouldn't be playing. Part of my competitive pleasure is pushing myself to the limit. It is an inner conflict with which every competitor can identify. Sometimes I surprise myself. When I won the Masters for the second time, to hold all 4 professional major titles simultaneously, I was amazed at how I was able to get my game to peak 4 times within a year, exactly as I had worked so hard to do. The competition down the stretch at Augusta National was fierce and unforgettable. David Duval was making a run. Phil Mickelson was right there, and I managed to make a putt or two. If that kind of competition doesn't get your juices flowing, nothing will. I was fortunate to get some breaks and win, but everyone was a winner that day. There is no greater joy in this game than being able to give back. I love working with kids, helping them achieve their dreams, whether in golf or life. I owe a debt of gratitude to a lot of people who helped me attain my dreams, and I'm determined to help others. I take my responsibility as a role model very seriously. By positively influencing others, I believe I can make a difference. The smiles on the faces of kids grateful to get a few minutes of instruction warm my heart. I am grateful to golf for giving me that feeling. In the big picture, what truly matters is the lives we touch. That is how we measure our legacy. I measure mine in the warmth of those smiles. My parents have been the biggest influence in my life. They taught me to give of myself, my time, talent, and most of all, my love. I have never forgotten those early lessons of life. I hope you won't forget the lessons you've learned from this program. I love this game because it has loved me. I love it because it has allowed me to give you the best of me, and that is the most fun of all. Afterward. The 1996 U.S. Amateur at Pumpkin Ridge relates to the way a golfer intent on improving should approach this program. I had just busted a big drive on the par 4 16th hole in my second round match against Jerry Corville, a very good player from Connecticut. When I got to my ball, I found it had settled into the first cut of rough, about 1 foot off the fairway. Amid dead silence, I was about to pull a club from my bag when a familiar voice rang out from 50 yards away. "You can't count that as a fairway hit in regulation." I looked across the fairway, and there was my dad, standing under a tree, smiling. Leave it to Pop to yell something like that while I was trying to win a tournament, which at that point was the most important one of my life, going for my 3rd amateur in a row. It was so much like him. I just shook my head and laughed. Pop's calling attention to a detail like that was indicative of the way he raised me. He didn't believe in cutting corners, not in golf or anything else. His approach to achieving a goal was to formulate a game plan and proceed systematically. Along the way, you assessed and reassessed your strengths and weaknesses honestly. If a ball stopped 1 inch off the fairway, you didn't count it as a fairway hit. That philosophy is the best way to get the most out of this program. Now that you've heard it once, listen to it again. Spend a bit more time on each section and concentrate on mastering the individual points I've laid out for you. Practice them. Think about them. Don't move ahead until you're able to perform each movement to your satisfaction. It takes some time and effort, but it's worth it. What at first appears to be drudgery in golf turns out to be extremely interesting, fun, and rewarding. I love walking onto the practice range with a specific goal of ironing out some swing problems. I'm never intimidated by the problem, though I do get frustrated sometimes trying to solve it. I know the answer is out there. I hope this program has helped your game already. Passing my knowledge on to you has been a great pleasure and a privilege.
Hi, this is Tiger again. Ultimately, golf is a journey full of learning and discovery. Hopefully, by listening to this program, you've discovered your game. One that is powerful, yet precise, consistent, yet exciting, impervious to pressure, yet yielding large doses of fun. After all, that's the real reason we play the game.
This has been an Hachette audio production of How I Play Golf, written by Tiger Woods, with the editors of Golf Digest, read by Walter Franks, with an introduction and afterword by Tiger Woods. Executive producer, Maya Thomas. Produced and directed by Rick Spencer. Text abridged by William Whittington. Production coordinated by Dennis Kao. Edited, mixed, and mastered by North Hollywood Sound. Digitally remastered by John Clem. How I Play Golf is also available in print from Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette Book Group. Text copyright 2001 by ETW Corporation. Audio production copyright and published 2001 by Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Except as permitted under the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, no part of this production may be reproduced, distributed, or transmitted in any form or by any means, or stored in a database or retrieval system without the prior written permission of the publisher.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.